True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Macchiarini took the Karolinska Institute by storm, not least among the surgeons who thought he was fantastic. Here was a colleague who was not only extremely competent in his handiwork, but he also seemed to be revolutionizing an entire science.
Compared to the old procedure that we did so far since 2008, a completely new approach where we don't use natural windpipes that are desiccated, but synthetic polymers to build a custom-made individual windpipe.
We did put a synthetic, and I was the one that stitched in the top end, and my thoracic colleague stitched in the bottom end of this synthetic implant. Even when I'm working with it, you could tell it was too rigid, it wasn't, and you couldn't see any evidence of any cells there. Microscopically, there may have been some cells. There was certainly no respiratory lining. You know, it was a bit of plastic, expensive bit of plastic. I couldn't see it working, and sure enough, it didn't work.
You don't have to be a doctor to know that a synthetic trachea cannot transform into a living trachea by applying bone marrow on it. For me, this was unbelievable. And no theoretical evidence, no experimental data supporting the thesis of regeneration. And I knew beforehand that it would lead to big disasters. If you implant it in a patient, you know that this patient will die. So this was so wrong that I wrote immediately a paper to the president of Karolinska, and look what's going on in your institution. That's completely wrong.
He claimed that Macchiarini's research studies were misleading the general public and the medical world, making people believe the plastic tracheas actually worked, despite it being physically impossible.
They made misuse of the hype around stem cells to introduce something completely impossible. To keep it clear, if I had to choose between the implantation of a synthetic trachea and the firing squad, I would certainly choose the last option because this is the less painful form of execution. It can sound very crude, but that's a real situation.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Is this the only episode of TCB that you haven't heard yet? If you finish listening to this episode and you're looking for something substantial and fun to fill the hours until your next visit to the quiet end, check out Call Your Girlfriend, a podcast for long-distance besties everywhere. It's a low-pressure, affirming hang with hosts and best friends, Aminatu So and Anne Friedman. Get ready for some much-needed woman-to-woman encouragement and real talk in these tough political times. Listen to Call Your Girlfriend at callyourgirlfriend.com or on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to TCB. All of these links are available at callyourgirlfriend.com.
Yeah, this is kind of reminding me of you talking to one of your buddies back in Michigan. Just that kind of comfortable relationship.
Yeah, it is pleasant to listen to. For several years, Dr. Paolo Macchiarini was known as a scientific pioneer, a super surgeon, and a miracle worker. He was turning the dream of regenerative medicine into a reality. While much of the scientific community was eager to believe he had made breakthroughs, not everyone was convinced. Most of his patients died within a few years of their surgeries, and the experimental procedures actually made their conditions much worse. Investigations revealed that he had actually falsified his data, as well as his medical credentials. While at the prestigious Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Macchiarini invented his technique. Instead of stripping the cells from donor windpipes, he had plastic scaffolds made to order. He gave his regenerating windpipes to at least 17 patients worldwide. The results have been disastrous. In 2014, Paolo Macchiarini was hailed as a gifted medical pioneer in an NBC special produced by Benita Alexander. Paolo and Benita became romantically involved and they planned to marry. But as the wedding day approached, the plans unraveled. Benita realized that Paolo had lied to her about a lot of things. For one thing, he was still married to his wife of 30 years. So why does an intelligent and skilled surgeon create a house of cards in his personal life and perform surgeries that he knows will result in suffering and death for his patients? As one surgeon put it, he would choose to die by firing squad before experiencing a death caused by one of these tracheal transplants. His experimental surgeries have been compared to the crimes of Nazi doctor Joseph Mengele, yet he remains free. Join us at the Quiet End today for a fascinating and horrifying discussion, Bad Medicine, the Downfall of Paolo Macchiarini. And please excuse my pronunciation throughout this episode. I'm doing my best.
Yeah, I'm just going to say Paolo.
That makes it easier.
Not even try to do Macchiarini.
But you do it better than I do.
Yeah, you got to roll it around a little.
Okay, let's do a beer so we can get started. This is a fascinating case.
It certainly is. So for my Italian beer, I'm going to do one called Duchessic Ale from Birra del Borgo in Borgo Rosa, Italy. Now, this is a Belgian Saison, and I forget who wrote in, but she was kind of chastising me for just reviewing stouts and IPAs.
So I've done that too.
You do that a lot.
Not a lot.
What I'm going to try to do over the next few weeks is begin to balance it out a little bit. So today I'm doing this Saison, and it's a delight. The other part of it is this is a collaboration with a famous Belgian brewery called Cantillon. So we've got this beautiful, hazy, honey-colored beer with this huge, huge white head and tons of lace. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And it's got this earthy, woody aroma with some tropical fruit, melony type stuff. Very good. Taste is up front, what you'd expect, sort of a funky sour taste. Then there's some herbal and grassy notes afterwards, and a nice lingering tartness. A medium-bodied beer, highly carbonated. It'll tickle your nose. But very, very, very nice beer.
All right, let's open it up.
Okay, and we'll head on down to the Quiet End.
Absolutely. Okay, here we are at the Quiet End. And can I just thank the bartender here, because as soon as he sees us come in, he gets out a stool, puts a pillow on it for your leg. Very accommodating, and we very much appreciate it.
He's A plus with me, that's for sure.
Okay. Well, let's start our discussion, Dick.
Okay. Yeah, this, as you said, I think this is one of our more fascinating cases, maybe because we're medically inclined. I don't know.
I think so. I think we're attracted to this kind of story.
This is just an amazing story.
It is.
So from what we know of Dr. Paolo Macchiarini, he's a smart man who established himself in the medical community as one of the top surgeons in the world. He was born to Italian parents who were living in Switzerland on August 22, 1958, and grew up in Basel. He described his childhood as difficult because he was always the outsider. He graduated from the University of Pisa in 1986 with a medical degree, and that same year he married an Italian woman, Emanuela Peccia. They have two grown children, a son and a daughter. Paolo graduated, as I said, from the medical school at the University of Pisa with a medical degree, and then he went on to earn a Master of Surgery degree from the same school in 1991. From 1990 to 1992, he was an assistant professor at the University of Pisa. He claimed in his CV that he completed a course in statistics and clinical research at the University of Alabama in Birmingham in 1989. He had degrees from the University of Franche-Comté, a master's in organ and tissue transplantation in 1994, and a doctorate in the same field in 1997. His primary area of study was regenerative medicine. Specifically, his field was tracheal transplants, where he seeded first biologic, which was cadaver tracheas, and synthetic, which was plastic, scaffolds with the patient's own stem cells. We're going to talk a lot about stem cells, so stay with us.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, Paolo developed some skepticism about his homeland. After I had graduated and specialized in thoracic surgery, he was quoted as saying in the Irish Times, I wanted to enter university to continue my studies in that field. I was blocked. I was told not to apply for the job because the result, even before the interviews, had already been decided. There were the usual people with pull in the queue in front of me. The Italian system, he told the British medical journal The Lancet in 2012, favors people who are linked to the politics or are sons of sons, but not the merits. I knew that in other countries this was not the fact, so I left. Knowing what we know, there may absolutely be more to the story than what Paolo has said about why he left Italy.
I think so.
Paolo entered into the world of academia, where he could both practice surgery and do research. He joined the University of Paris, Sud, where he was a full professor. Then in 2000, or 2001, depending on which CV of his you read, he became a full professor at Hanover Medical School in Germany. In 2005, he moved to Spain, where he was a full professor at an institute in Barcelona.
Paolo was involved in stem cell research, which is a popular topic with patients and with the media. Stem cells are cells in the human body that have the potential to become virtually any type of cell. In the bone marrow, they can become red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. Outside the bone marrow, they can become muscle cells, kidney cells, heart muscle cells, etc. Their potential has led to an incredible amount of research in the field. At the same time, for almost all applications, stem cells have promised far more than they have delivered. One big exception is in the leukemias and other cancers of the blood, where stem cell transplants have been performed successfully for quite a few years now.
Yeah, you know, the idea, here you've got a stem cell, which can differentiate virtually into any kind of cell you need. So it's an exciting idea, right? You could do most anything with them.
Well, theoretically, but it hasn't seemed to work out that way.
No, it hasn't.
There is an ever-widening gap between what is expected from stem cells and what they actually deliver. And an unfortunate side effect is also the rise of pseudoscientific stem cell therapies, which I know you really despise. Stem cell clinics have sprung up all over in the past several years, and they promise to cure just about anything you can think of. And in place of any clinical data, they just use testimonials. There are plenty of desperate patients who believe, because they've been told, that stem cells are the cure for them, and they can't wait any longer for mainstream medicine. So they and their loved ones easily fall victim to false hope.
Yeah, and scientists can also suffer from false hope. And to some extent, they believe Macchiarini because he told them what they wanted to hear. You can certainly see this in the speed with which his breakthroughs were accepted. So his first patient, who we'll talk about a little bit later, was named Claudia Castillo. And only 4 months after he did his surgery on her, his results, which were provisional but very positive, were published online by The Lancet. And then it was all over the news. And certainly The Lancet is a very, very prestigious medical journal from Great Britain.
Oh, absolutely. I remember using it in college as a reference.
Yeah, so something in The Lancet is God's truth.
It should be.
Right.
But we're seeing some real breakdown here, I feel like.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the popular press, I must say, has its own share of responsibility here. Human interest stories make it very sympathetic to publicize these unproven therapies. As studies have shown, the media often puts a very positive spin on stem cells, suggesting that the treatments are effective and that the risks are very low. And the press really did this for Paolo's windpipe replacements.
Well, they sure did.
His recognition as a world-renowned surgeon really began to rise in 2008 when he constructed a new airway for Claudia Castillo in Barcelona. He took a windpipe from a deceased donor, stripped away the cells, and seeded the windpipe with stem cells taken from Claudia's own bone marrow. He then transplanted this into her left bronchus. The operation was a success, and Claudia had no complications from the procedure, at least initially. Claudia had already been operated on by Paolo. She had complications from tuberculosis, and he had previously resected her trachea, which means that he cut out the damaged area and just sutured the healthy ends back together. Now, he apparently could have done the same type of surgery on her left bronchus, but he opted for this transplant. And I think most people pretty much know what the bronchus and the trachea is, but can you just give us a quick description of the anatomy of that?
Sure. Well, the trachea is your windpipe, right? So it goes down into your chest and it divides in two. And those are the main stem bronchi. There's a right and a left. So they go to the lungs. So that's how the lungs are aerated. So this is the surgery. And I can kind of see, I guess, wanting to do his new method, even though he could have done the safer, more easily performed surgery like he'd done already. But yeah, he's got this brilliant idea and he wants to test it. And, you know, the basic idea is with the seeding of the stem cells, they differentiate into cells that make up a bronchus or a windpipe, and you've got a perfect replacement.
Well, that sounds great, but there's no proof that that would ever happen or ever had happened.
No, not at the time.
Not now.
I know not now, as we do know. But
as he went ahead with this is
at the time when he first did this. This is real cutting-edge surgery.
Yes, but a lot of doctors would say it was ridiculous and there was no way it was going to work in the first place.
In retrospect, that's certainly true.
Well, I think there were some doctors at the time, but no one was listening. I mean, you're correct about that, right?
There's at least one
yes.
who was highly critical.
Yes.
And wasn't listened to.
So I guess the big promise of this type of surgery would be that stem cells would obviate, at least in the long term, the need for immunosuppressive agents.
Yeah. Now, so if you transplant a donor trachea, you're going to need to use some immunosuppressive agents for a time, because otherwise the body will reject that foreign tissue.
Now, is it just for a time? I was under the impression it was forever.
Well, I mean, at least according to his theory, once his stem cells differentiate into that person's own cells, tracheal cells, then you don't need immunosuppressives anymore because it's not a foreign protein.
But there's no data to back up that that would happen.
No. I mean, that's all theoretical. And certainly with his plastic trachea, more on that later.
Yeah.
But if it's an inert substance like plastic, which has no antigens, nothing that the body's immune system is going to react against, you wouldn't need immunosuppressives at all.
But let's talk a little bit about what a trachea is made of. It's not just a straight tube. It has properties to it. It has a mucosal lining.
Yeah. But you're still going to be able to have the stem cells differentiate into the cells that would make up a trachea.
According to his theory.
According to his theory.
Well, this apparent scientific breakthrough in Barcelona didn't go unnoticed, of course. Officials in Italy vigorously pursued him. Enrico Rossi, Tuscany's top health official, made Paolo an offer that he couldn't refuse. He would give him a state-of-the-art laboratory, surgical privileges at Florence's Carigi Hospital, and a full professorship. However, Italian law required that in order to appoint a person to a full professorship without open competition, that person would need to show an equivalent position had been held by him at a comparable university. So in the end, although Paolo's appointment was preordained, he never did become a full professor there.
Right. And you kind of alluded to this previously when you're talking about his dissatisfaction with the politics of Italy's doctor system.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And even though he claimed to have been a full professor at his previous employment, he wasn't. So he never did become a full professor in Italy. In the two or so years that he was there. So following this initial success, or this initial apparent success, Paolo performed 9 more tracheal transplants over the next 2 years. In each case, he used a donor trachea, again, that's from a cadaver, coated with the patient's stem cells. Now, of these 9 patients, 8 of them died, either from their underlying disease or from complications of the surgery. The one surviving patient was a 10-year-old Irish boy who had been born with a hypoplastic trachea, and that just means it wasn't fully developed. So he had just a very small underdeveloped trachea, and he needed to have a series of stents put in to keep his airway open.
Let's explain what a stent is.
A stent is just a tube, basically, to keep an airway or an area open. So if he's got this teeny tiny underdeveloped trachea, as he grows, it doesn't grow, so his airway gets smaller and smaller, and it becomes more and more difficult for him to breathe. So with a stent, they just insert that, and it widens the airway, and he's able to breathe.
But that didn't solve the problem for him?
No, and there were complications. I mean, in a trachea like that, you can have some perforations, all sorts of difficulties, so which he had. Mm-hmm. So it was apparent that he wasn't going to be able to survive that long. Now, this kid, this Irish kid, and I wish I could have found a little more info. What I did find that as of late 2017, he was still living. And he had this surgery done in like 2010, somewhere around there, 2011. But the best I could find is that as of late 2017, he was alive. Although from what I did read, his quality of life was suffering. For instance, he apparently had been hospitalized virtually the entire time since the surgery before he finally did go home in 2017. So that's like 5 or 6 years.
Right.
Basically being hospital bound.
So this was no miracle cure by any stretch.
Sure doesn't sound it.
No.
So he's got these 9 patients plus Castillo, the first one. She's continued to live or still alive. And this Irish kid. But everyone else, nope.
Well, as devil's advocate, I would just say that these people might have died without the intervention.
Yeah, no, I that's an important point. Thank you. These are pretty sick patients. And they had cancers, they had other diseases that would probably shorten their lives anyway.
So where we really get into dangerous territory, I feel, is when we get to the plastic tracheas and when we get to people who could have lived decent lives without the intervention.
Yeah, he went from doing it in sort of a compassionate need type of scenario, and we'll get into that too, to doing it more as an elective procedure in patients.
Yeah, which really I think is terrible.
Well, that's where you get in all sorts of issues.
Yes, exactly. Well, in 2011, his career was continuing to soar, and he was working at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. The professors there are the ones that select the Nobel Prize winners in physiology or medicine. And Paolo had refined his technique. So now he was using these made-to-order plastic scaffolds for the stem cells. And the first person to receive one of these was Andamarim Bayen, doctoral student in geology at the University of Iceland, who suffered from cancer. His apparent recovery from the surgery really made Paolo a superstar.
Well, and this is where some of the dissension or dissenters started to really come forward. Because it's one thing to look at cadaver transplants, at least you have the same tissue. But if you look at like pictures of him holding up these plastic windpipes, they look like toys. And if you think about it, certainly with hindsight anyway, there's absolutely no way this is going to work. But they were so swept up in this stem cell research and studies that he went ahead and did it.
Well, I can see everyday people, but thinking that other surgeons and physicians were falling for this is really incredible to me.
Well, it is. But again, Paolo was portraying everything as a unqualified success.
Yes.
And you want to believe it. Here's this guy who's skilled, he's a great doctor, and he's saying, I've invented this procedure that's going to work beautifully in so many people.
Well, yeah. And he's one of these con men who can convince you of just about anything.
He certainly can.
So he came to the attention of Meredith Vieira of NBC TV in the fall of 2012, after she read a laudatory article on him in the New York Times. She and her producer, Benita Alexander, began interviewing Paolo in early 2013, and this culminated in a 2-hour documentary aptly titled A Leap of Faith. In hindsight, the documentary was a real puff piece. It was just filled with praise for Paolo's genius and his expertise. Made him look like a rock star.
It sure did. I mean, Meredith Vieira says in this piece, just imagine a world where any injured or diseased organ or body part you have is simply replaced by a new artificial one, literally man-made in the lab, just for you. Now that's so far from what the true story is. But boy, doesn't that sound great?
But there were scientists that were going along with this in the documentary.
There were.
So it was nominated for an Emmy, I believe, or at least put forth for a nomination. And then that was retracted.
Yeah, and NBC put it out there for an Emmy. I don't think it was ever actually nominated.
Okay.
And in any event, it did get retracted.
And it's been removed from the internet. Yeah, Pretty much fully.
You can't find nothing.
Well, we did find a YouTube version with very distorted audio. And I found a little 7-minute piece in an article. But it's really hard to get a hold of this because I think it's an embarrassment to NBC.
Well, on many different levels it is, yeah.
Yeah.
So prominent in this documentary that NBC News did was the story of Hannah Warren. Now, she was a little 2-year-old girl who had been born without a trachea. Now, you think, okay, she can't breathe. But she had basically, I mean, her trachea was just kind of a blind pouch. But there was a tract between it and the esophagus. There's a little fistula there. And by keeping that open, she was able to get some air into her lungs by a circuitous route.
So she wasn't able to eat orally?
No, because she had a tube down there to keep her breathing. And no, she was tube fed.
And she wasn't expected to survive.
Oh, she was, I mean, her parents had been told she wasn't going to survive.
Oh, her parents were heartbreaking to watch.
Yeah. And there was a time when she was just a very young infant that she was in a horrible amount of distress, and the hospital called and said, we don't think she's going to survive, and you got to be ready for her to die. And her parents were ready for this to happen. She somehow pulled through. And then they heard about Dr. Macchiarini.
And he seemed like a savior to them.
He did. Now, besides Hannah on this special or in this documentary, there were some other people featured. One was the Eritrean guy, Bien. Another one was Yulia Tulik. She had a tracheostomy, which was a result of a car accident. For those of you who don't know, tracheostomy is simply a hole in your neck with a tube inserted to keep your windpipe open. So it bypasses most of the trachea.
Yeah, which I imagine it's uncomfortable and there are a lot of issues with it, but I think a big part of it for this young woman was the aesthetics.
Oh, yeah.
She didn't feel attractive anymore, which you can't blame her. Plus, she didn't have her voice.
No, she had to plug the trach tube to be able to speak.
But it wasn't life-threatening.
No, she was pretty much okay.
Yeah.
Except that she had this trachea that she hated, the tracheostomy that she hated. There was one other patient kind of featured in this. His name was Christopher Lyles, who had some form of throat cancer.
Yeah, he was an American.
Right.
And he died quickly after his surgery.
Now, she also interviewed a physician, just one. There were certainly more than one, but this one physician, Dr. Joseph Vacanti, who was highly critical of Macchiarini and his work. But in the documentary, this was portrayed as a minority voice.
Yeah, almost just kind of
Yeah, we got to present both sides to this. So here's this one guy.
Yeah.
But there were others.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll get into that. There were some at the Institute who actually suffered repercussions for trying to speak out against it.
There were.
So the documentary was aired in June of 2014. Now, during the filming of this, A Leap of Faith documentary, Benita Alexander and Paolo began to have an affair. And they found themselves together in Illinois for a period of weeks in the spring of 2013. They were brought there by the NBC special. And they started getting together often for quiet dinners, became romantic. A trachea transplant on Hannah Warren, the Korean-Canadian girl, was being performed at Children's Hospital of Illinois in Peoria, and the procedure was risky. Paolo's technique was still a work in progress, even for adults. Christopher Lyles, as I mentioned, the American who became the second person to receive an artificial trachea, died less than 4 months after his surgery. He's a brilliant scientist and a great technical surgeon, said Dr. Richard Pearl, who had operated with Paolo in Illinois. Like others, Pearl described Paolo as a Renaissance man, fluent in half a dozen languages. A friend of Benita's would compare Macchiarini to the most interesting man in the world, the famous guy in the Dos Equis beer commercials.
Yeah, that guy. Well, they have a new guy now.
Yes.
But the original guy is a New Hampshire resident.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought he was a European.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, they have a new one now who's also kind of cool looking.
Yeah, but not as cool as the original.
Well, no one ever is. But Benita was aware of the conflict of interest that she was in here, being romantically involved with him and being the producer of this show. but she would admit that she was swept up and really in love with him and she chose to overlook it. This guy was, you know, fairly handsome, very charming. I think she was really just taken with him. And she was in a vulnerable period of her life as well, she would point out.
Yes, she was. And certainly, Paolo is a force.
Yes, yeah.
He's pretty dynamic. He's apparently brilliant. He's developing this medical groundbreaking procedure. Yeah, I'm going to hook up with him.
Most women would.
Sure.
And why would you think that someone would be at that prestigious institute and not be legitimate? And I think that's what it all boils down to here, is anyone working in that institute should be legitimate.
Exactly.
Now, she admitted that she knew he was married, but she thought he was separated and going through a divorce when they met.
Oh, did she?
Yes.
Okay.
So he proposed to her on Christmas Day 2013. And I think that's why they had this long engagement, because he had to get his divorce. And her ex-husband, the father of her young daughter, was dying of cancer. And she would say that Paolo was just wonderful with her and her daughter, helping them get through this. So after the proposal, Paolo told Benita he wouldn't be around for the new year because he was on call for emergency VIP surgery. When she asked for details, she said that he told her he was in a group of highly classified doctors from around the world who cater to the world's VIPs. Over time, Paolo would reveal to Benita that he had operated on Bill and Hillary Clinton, as well as Emperor Akihito of Japan. He even claimed that he had been called on to consult on Pope John Paul II.
I'm looking at this. I'm reading this. And to me, here is where my bullshit meter starts going way up.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, she's a smart person. She should have. I hate saying should have. But I'm a very important doctor, and I cater to the world's VIPs. I've operated on the Clintons.
Well, I see that in hindsight, but if you're involved in this, why not? He is a world-renowned surgeon. Why wouldn't he be doing these things? It kind of makes sense. Somebody has to be their doctor, right?
Well, yeah, it does. But that's just, to me, beyond the realm of belief.
Okay.
It is.
So your realm of belief is a little bit narrower than hers.
Yes.
But you're not in love, too.
Right.
So let's be real about that.
Well, I'm not in love with Paolo.
Well, right. So in the months that followed the proposal, Benita and Paolo traveled extensively. They went to the Bahamas, Turkey, Mexico, Greece, and Italy, and they began this intense planning for their wedding. They set the date for July 11th, 2015. So their desire to marry in the Catholic Church was complicated by the fact that they were both divorced.
Or soon to be divorced.
Yes.
In Paolo's case.
Right. And Benita was Episcopalian. Paolo said that he would try and fix things. So as far as Benita could recall, Paolo told her in October 2014 that he had met with Pope Francis, the new pope, and the pope had consented to their marriage, and he'd even offered to officiate it. Not only that, the pope had offered to host the wedding at his summer residence, Castel Gandolfo.
And again, here's my meter going up again.
Absolutely.
As far as I know, I mean, if you said to me, the Pope is going to marry us, I say, come on. That is not true at all. But she believed it.
Yes.
So this was going to be some wedding, wasn't it?
Very glamorous.
Millions of dollars were going to be spent on this. So among the guests were President and Mrs. Obama, the Clintons, Vladimir Putin, and Francis Nicolas Sarkozy. Wow. And I think they were inviting Sir Elton John, some sports figures. I mean, this was just a 4-star, 5-star, 12-star wedding.
Exclusive.
Andrea Bocelli would sing during the service. And this very famous restaurant in Florence, the Enoteca Pinciori, was going to cater the affair. This is a Michelin 3-star restaurant. So we got it. Holy cow. And then besides her wedding dress, Benita was going to need 3 other gowns just to get through this wedding day or wedding period. The invitations were sheathed in lambskin. Now, don't get too pissed off about that.
Well, yeah, I certainly wouldn't purchase that.
No.
But on the topic of the situation, Benita paid thousands for the dresses and she paid $10,000 for the invitations. So this is where my radar would go off when I have to start paying for things, because that hits me in the pocket.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. If he gave me the money and said, here, buy invitations, I wouldn't buy lambskin, but I'd buy expensive ones if he gave me the money.
Well, sure. Look who they're going to.
And if he was paying for the dresses, sure. But if I have to start paying for these things, I'm going to be much more skeptical. Now, he said he'd pay her back, but why? Because she was well off. She had a good job.
She was pretty
comfortable. But not super rich.
I don't think she was rich by any standards.
Well, on some standards, she was.
Yeah, but she lived in New York, and she...
Most people who live in the city are rich compared to a lot of standards, yeah.
And she had a kid in private school. I mean,
she was well off.
She was wealthy enough to afford some nice things.
Right. But not this.
No.
No. And her friends that were invited purchased airline tickets and planned their lives around attending this amazing event. Paolo even claimed that he had secured a castle where the guests would stay over these few days.
Yep, we're going first class all the way.
So everybody's really involved with this dress designer. He actually designed a dress that was like a wedding gown, but when they went out and danced on the floor, he would twirl her and the long part would come off and it would be like a mini little dancing dress.
Yep.
It's crazy.
And the gowns were just awesome.
And even if you knew all these people and had all this money, why would you do this? What's the point?
Well, that's how you and I view things.
Yes. It's a waste of money. You could give that money to a good cause.
Yes.
Think of the dogs you could adopt.
Okay. So May 13th, 2015 was Benita's last day of work at NBC because she's preparing to move to Europe. She's going to live in Barcelona with her new husband.
Why wouldn't she? He showed her this beautiful home in Barcelona where she and her daughter would live. Who wouldn't go?
Yeah. And then she notified her daughter's school that her child would not be returning in the fall. The very next day, her life was turned upside down. Benita received an email from a friend, and the subject line simply said, "The Pope." And in the message was a link that showed that Pope Francis was going to be in South America in July, the very time when he was supposed to be marrying Benita and Paolo.
Oops.
Oops. So Benita confronted Paolo, who told her it was all a scheduling error, and that the wedding was still on.
Now here I would be getting suspicious.
And more than suspicious.
And we find out when this happens that some of her friends had been suspicious for a while, but they saw her so happy, giddy with excitement. What are you going to do?
Yeah, you don't want to be the Debbie Downer of this thing, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you say that to a girlfriend, they're going to think you're just jealous because they're going to get defensive.
Well, I wouldn't know.
Right, but that's how women work.
Okay.
So if you have a friend that has all this wonderful stuff happening and you're skeptical that it's real, you got to be careful about bringing that up because they're going to say, well, you're just jealous. So I can see why they kind of held out saying anything. But it kind of makes me feel better to realize that some of her friends were suspicious because a lot of this is suspicious. And I can kind of see why she would fall for it because she's wrapped up in this whole romance.
Yeah.
It's like a fairy tale.
At the same time, though, I mean, a lot of these friends were suspicious sort of after the fact.
Well, yeah, you know? They'd say, oh, I was suspicious. Yeah. But were they really? We don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
But finally, at this point, Benita was questioning everything that he had told her. So you give her credit there.
Yeah, she's finally waking up.
She's not that naive.
Nope.
So over the course of the next month or so, Benita, with the help of a private investigator she hired, found out that essentially everything that he told her was a lie. It was quite shocking. And probably humiliating.
Oh, I can't imagine how you would feel finding this stuff out. I
mean,
this whole thing just collapsed. Boom.
Well, you're losing this person who you thought was your life partner.
Mm-hmm.
That your daughter's bonded to and cares about.
Her child seemed to adore Paolo.
Yep. He was charming.
Yeah.
Plus, you've told all your friends, you've quit your job, you've spent this money. It's humiliating.
Mm-hmm. So the first thing was, he wasn't divorced. Holy cow.
Yeah.
He was still married to his wife of almost 30 years.
And there was no plan for a divorce.
Not that anyone could find.
Nope.
The Vatican had never heard of Paolo. He was never the Pope's physician. The Pope had never promised to officiate at his wedding. He never offered his summer residence for the wedding. None of that. Andrea Bocelli's manager said that Andrea does not sing at weddings and had never been contacted by Paolo. And the manager of the restaurant said likewise, we've never heard of him. And on and on.
It went on and on. So, one footnote to this whole betrayal was that Benita traveled to Spain to confront Paolo with a couple of her friends, and she disguised herself in a blonde wig. So two of her friends traveled to the house that was supposed to have been her new home, and Benita remained in the car while the friends went up to his door. So they spoke with him, and they said he just wanted to get them out of there as quickly as possible. They gave him a bottle of wine from Benita, and they watched him throw it in the trash after they left. Now, behind him in the house, they had seen a young woman and two little kids in the house. So this gave way to speculation that he had a whole other family in addition to the one he had with his 30-year wife.
Yeah, because these were young kids.
And a younger woman.
And a younger woman.
So later on, I think it was on a Dr. Oz clip that I found, Benita said that he had 3 or 4 families, if you included her and her daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. So live in a huge lie. So Benita was continuing to try and find him and talk to him after that and ask him why he had done what he did. But other than this brief phone conversation that was talked about in her special, He Lied About Everything, she was never able to really meet up with him.
No, let's take a little break here before we get into the really interesting stuff.
Okay, I have a really exciting announcement to make on behalf of Payne Lindsay and Oxygen. In a one-night special TV event, Oxygen brings to life Payne Lindsay's hit true crime podcast, Up and Vanished. In 2016, Payne took a deep dive into the disappearance of Tara Grinstead, a young teacher who went missing 13 years ago. Payne has dedicated himself to Tara's case every day, slowly unlocking the secrets that her small town couldn't shake. Tara was last seen on October 21, 2005, in Ocilla, Georgia. She was heading home from a barbecue and suddenly went missing. Tara's story remained a mystery for over a decade. Then Payne stepped in. His search for the truth got the town to start talking. And the Up and Vanished podcast became a national phenomenon, reaching over 240 million people. But the story doesn't end there. Payne is still at work determined to find answers. Don't miss Up and Vanished, a one-night special TV event based on the hit podcast. That's on Sunday, November 18th at 7 on Oxygen, the new network for crime.
I'm going to watch that.
Oh yeah, you'll be watching it with me.
Okay, it's a date. This episode is also sponsored by ADT. ADT can design and install a smart home just for you that is backed by 24/7 protection. Explore the vast number of things you can do with your secure smart home. Like doorman service. This is an ADT automation that unlocks the doors for packages, friends, neighbors, or your kids. Or turndown service, which is an automation that arms your system, locks your doors, and turns down your lights and thermostat. There's lots of things they can do for you.
Oh, absolutely. They even have this worry-free getaway service that lets you arm your system, lock up, and set lighting schedules before you go on vacation. And this is all controlled from the ADT app or the sound of your voice, and it's backed by the 24/7 protection. Don't worry about installing or configuring your system either, because ADT will do that for you.
So just visit ADT.com/smart to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.
So Paolo's deceit was so out there that Vanity Fair did an investigation and wrote an article about Benita Alexander's experience. Vanity Fair sought out the opinion of Harvard professor Ronald Schuetten, an expert on psychopaths, who gave a probable diagnosis. Macchiarini is the extreme form of a con man, he said. He's clearly bright in his accomplishments, but he cannot contain himself. There's a void in his personality that he seems to want to fill by conning more and more people. So this left the big question to be deliberated. If Macchiarini was a pathological liar in matters of love, what about in his medical research? Was he conning his patients, his colleagues, and perhaps the entire scientific community? I think so, in many ways.
Well, the answer to that question came only a few weeks later, when Swedish television began broadcasting a three-part exposé of Macchiarini and his work. It was titled Experimenten, The Experiments. Now, it claimed some of his patients had died, but Macchiarini had not discussed potential risks with them before the surgery. Sweden's prestigious Karolinska Institute said it was dismantling his research group and not renewing his contract. A top official at the institute that awards the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine stepped down over the controversy.
It's a big deal, right?
It's a big, huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
This series showed quite convincingly that Paolo's artificial windpipes were not life-saving miracles as people had all been led to believe. Now, as a matter of fact, they seemed to do more harm than good, which was something that Macchiarini had concealed for years, or at least downplayed in his scientific articles, press releases, and interviews.
Well, when you see the Russian young woman, what was her name?
Yulia.
Yulia? When you see her getting ready for surgery, she looks happy, like she just thinks this is some kind of normal surgery that's done often.
Yeah, she's smiling and everything.
And people are questioning her about her nerves, and she just seems oblivious to the fact of how risky this was.
Yeah, but then you see her pictures post-operatively. Not a happy woman.
No, she suffered.
She's clearly suffering.
Yeah. So faced with this public relations disaster, the Karolinska Institute immediately promised to investigate the allegations. But then, within just days, they suddenly announced that Paolo's contract would not be extended. So his fall was quick.
His fall was quick. Yeah, but even then he kind of landed upright. We'll talk about that. But still, stuff started happening and boom, he's without a job. So he might have had some suspect things from earlier in his career. We learned that he had been arrested in Italy in 2012. Now, he was charged with extortion because he apparently asked patients at the hospital in Careggi for money, which would expedite their procedures. So that sounds like extortion, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
Now, these charges were dismissed in 2015. Then the question also arose about whether Paolo had been a professor prior to his arrival at Careggi. He was eventually allowed to submit a corrected CV. Now, this in turn led to a closer examination of his original CV, and this was stuff I gleaned from the Vanity Fair article. The University of Alabama said the only record they had on Paolo indicated he had done 6 months out of a 3-year fellowship in hematology oncology. Now, that's different from his claim that he had been awarded a degree in statistics. And they tried to contact the school in France. They never got any response to them. Hanover Medical School in Germany, where he said he was a full professor, said that he was never a full nor an associate professor, but merely an adjunct professor.
Yeah. So there are a lot of questions here about why he was allowed to continue his experiments for so long, and some answers have come from the official inquiries into the Karolinska Institute and the Karolinska University Hospital. They identified many problems with the way the organizations handled him. Paolo's fame had also won him some wealthy backers, and these included Harriet Wahlberg, who was the vice chancellor of the Karolinska Institute in 2010, when Paolo was recruited. She pushed through his appointment despite the fact that he had some very negative references and some dubious claims on his resume. So this set a dangerous example. It showed department heads, as well as colleagues, that they should give him special treatment, and that's what seemed to happen. Very scary and dangerous. He could pretty much do as he pleased. In the first couple of years at Karolinska, he put plastic airways into 3 patients. Since this was radically new, he and his colleagues were expected to do surgery on animals first, but no animal testing was done. Now, I just have to add here, as an animal lover and an animal rights advocate, I'm compelled to mention that there are valid alternatives to animal testing, such as in vitro testing with human tissue. Also, when they bathed the plastic tracheas in bone marrow and stem cells, there was no evidence that the cells were growing onto the plastic, so they probably shouldn't have gone ahead from there. This should have been a sign that this idea could not possibly work.
Well, yeah. He found ways around this by claiming this was a compassionate use or compassionate need, which is an idea that basically the patient is so sick they're going to die and you might as well do the surgery, which was false anyway. But that's how he got through. Because typically, as you said, they're going to do testing. You have to do stages of testing. So what should have happened?
Well, as a person out there who might need surgery someday, I'd like to think that there's some kind of procedure that needs to be followed, for fuck's sake.
Right. But he didn't. But typically, you would do testing, probably in vitro testing first. Then if things were proceeding the way you wanted or they should be, you started doing animal testing.
Well,
I know. You say no, but just...
That's so, how it usually goes.
So you'd try small animals like rats or something, move to larger animals, and then maybe to baboons, pigs, bigger animals. Each time you're making sure that you're... procedure is relatively safe and producing results. And then you might start testing on humans. Now, he didn't do any of this stuff. And again, his excuse or his reason was that this was compassionate need, which it wasn't.
But then he just kind of jumped off from there and did people who weren't in compassionate need.
No, although he claimed they were.
Yeah. The Swedish series began with Paolo's rise following Claudia Castillo's surgery in 2008 and his move to the Karolinska Institute. By this point, some of the early transplant patients, a total of 10, were beginning to have problems, and this is when Paolo proposed the use of plastic as a scaffold for the stem cells. The first patient was Andemariam Bien. After his transplant, Paolo published the results in the prestigious medical journal The Lancet. Dr. Pierre Dallaire stated bluntly that there was no scientific reason that a synthetic trachea would function. His remarks were heard at the beginning of our podcast, and Dr. Dallaire tried to warn officials at the Karolinska Institute of his concerns, but no action was ever taken.
Yeah, and after Bien, 3 other patients received artificial tracheas. They've all died. Macchiarini then made the strange and kind of radical decision to try the synthetic trachea as an elective procedure in relatively healthy patients. The procedure had never been tested adequately, yet Russian authorities gave him permission to start a clinic in Russia. And Paolo's team invited people to submit videos of why they should be chosen, and the winner was Yulia Tulik, who had been left with a tracheostomy after an automobile accident. Now, other than having to live with a trach, Yulia was quite healthy, and she was living a full life with her husband. They had a young son as well. She said in her video that she wanted to feel normal and pretty again, and she wanted to be able to sing to her son.
But she seemed to have no idea of how risky this was.
No. Well, and it just kind of turns my stomach that it's like a game show.
Absolutely.
In terms of who's going to get the trachea. It's just...
I agree. That's just...
Yeah.
I don't like it.
So Yulia had the surgery and was reported by Macchiarini to be doing well. The reality was that she had complications almost immediately. So this first transplant failed, and this was replaced by a second one, which also failed. She lived in pain for a little over 2 years, and her mother said she smelled all the time like rotting flesh.
So explain to me what happened, why we have the necrosis. What was happening to these people that had the plastic trachs in their bodies?
Well, obviously the stem cells weren't populating the plastic, and the plastic was sutured to the end of the trachea, but it's not like a joint where you just kind of hammer things in there. You've attached this plastic piece to a tube that's less rigid than the plastic. So ideally, you've got stem cells taking over and it gets to be more like trachea, but if it doesn't happen, all you got is a hunk of plastic that's going to work its way free. So that's what's happened. And one of the patients, I think it was BN. I mean, it was such a disaster with sites of infection and bleeding that the piece of trachea could be lifted out of the neck without cutting it or anything. It was just kind of dangling there.
So these people were miserable.
Horribly miserable.
In one of the articles of his that I read in The Lancet, he was saying how there was epithelialization of the plastic, saying that tissue was growing on it.
Right.
And there's outright, no evidence of that.
Outright lie.
He also denied that there was any fungus or bacteria, but in all cases there was. It seems like the only people who had any hopes of surviving had that removed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I read somewhere. Sorry. I know that's poor documentation. One of the articles we read said that he had done about 20 of these, counting the cadaver tracheal transplants and the plastic transplants with the stem cells. And there were about 20 patients, and they're all dead except for one.
Wow.
And that person has a trach.
So no one's living with one of these plastic trachs. No one.
No one.
No.
So the producer of the series, Lindquist, found some unedited film footage of Paolo. In one segment, he was speaking to the company that manufactured his plastic tracheas, and he was apparently aware that the scaffold wasn't working. But he went ahead anyway with Julia's surgery using that kind of trachea. And then in another interview shortly before her surgery, he was also aware that all three plastic scaffolds that they had on hand were defective, but he went ahead anyway and performed the surgery using the least defective scaffold of the three.
Wow. I mean, what does that say to you? It's just uncommon fuckery. Like, he just does not give a shit.
He doesn't.
He just wants to plow forward. These people's lives are just nothing to him. And at the same time, they're taking pictures of him at the bedside of his patients like he's this wonderful person. It makes me really sick. So while he was off traveling the world, his colleagues at the Karolinska University Hospital were caring for the patients who'd been operated on there by him, and they found a huge discrepancy between what they were seeing and what was being reported by Paolo. Now, as an example, Paolo was describing Bayen's airway as open and lined with healthy new tissue, while in reality his airway was almost closed and he needed stenting just to keep it open. Plus, there was a massive infection.
Yeah, he did not die a good death.
No, he would have been better to just die of the cancer. He may have lived longer also, because he didn't last very long. And I imagine how horrible it was for his family to see him like that.
I can't.
So in 2013, four whistleblowers began efforts to make Karolinska leaders aware of this situation. They met again and again with officials, but nothing seemed to work. In fact, there was retaliation against these whistleblowers. They were threatened with dismissal, and one of them was charged by Paolo of stealing his data. So finally, in late 2014, Karolinska officials agreed to an external investigation, and this was headed up by Dr. Bengt Gurdin of Uppsala University. And I don't know if I pronounced that correctly at all.
I think so. It's a Swedish university.
Yes.
Famous.
So his report corroborated nearly everything the whistleblowers had claimed, yet the institute overruled him. Vice Chancellor Anders Hamsten told reporters at a news conference that Paolo had the full trust of the Karolinska Institute. The Lancet approved the decision in an editorial titled, "Paolo Macchiarini is not guilty of scientific misconduct." But of course, they would change their minds.
They have. So he was fired, Paolo was fired from Karolinska Institute in March of 2016. Then he was indicted for involuntary manslaughter. Institutional leaders lost their positions, and scholars began to question the legitimacy of the Nobel Prize that was awarded by the Karolinska Institute.
Well, sure, I mean, that would undermine everything they do.
Yeah, I mean, if they're turning their backs on all the evidence against Paolo and claiming he was great, huh.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paolo came back to Sweden to give his version of events about the failed trachea transplants that he had performed, as well as some other complaints. He had two core messages. He extended the lives of the dying patients by transplanting them with untested plastic tracheas. And he did all this certainly not behind someone's back, but with the full knowledge, approval, and supervision of his colleagues at the Karolinska Institute. So there's the core of the problem, Dick.
Yes, the institute and the hospital allowed this to happen.
You're always going to have con men out there, and they need to be more careful,
yeah.
More vigilant.
Mm-hmm. So this certainly would lead to the question of how this could have happened, right?
Absolutely.
So we talked a while ago about how stem cell research is the very hot, overly hyped topic that it is. And certainly hospitals and institutions are in competition for the latest stem cell star. So much so that they could be willing to overlook things that would not ordinarily be overlooked. So, and certainly in Paolo's case, the prestige of the Institute gave the procedure an air of authority. Because if the Karolinska Institute is involved in this, it must be good.
Yeah, why wouldn't smaller hospitals, less prestigious hospitals, do it then?
Right. And he had the full backing of this great medical journal in Great Britain, The Lancet. So I can kind of see how he got away with it for a while, because he wasn't Joe Blow from Florida doing this surgery in a little county hospital.
I can see how he got away with it at other hospitals, but I can't see how Karolinska didn't nip this in the bud immediately.
Because they were just as starstruck as Benita Alexander.
I guess so.
They wanted to have...
He must have been some charmer.
...cutting-edge surgeon so they could claim, you know, look who's working for us.
Yeah.
They were taken in also. But they shouldn't be. They shouldn't be.
No. Also, by invoking compassionate use for terminal patients, officials allowed Paolo to avoid the ethical review that normally would have occurred in this type of study.
Right.
So that's kind of a loophole, which has a place. There are times when this is something that's legitimate.
Yeah, but once, for sure, once he started operating on an elective basis rather than an emergency basis, he loses the compassionate use argument.
Okay, but I'm going to take that further and say, even if they were dying, there was nothing compassionate about this, and he knew it. Well, so it was just something he was using. It was not legitimate in any case.
Yeah. So the end result, though, is that his experiments were a failure of institutional leadership by the Karolinska Institute. Not only because they dismissed credible findings, but then they attempted to cover them up and punish the surgeons and other people who reported their concerns. So obviously the Karolinska Institute would like to put this controversy behind them. But nothing really has changed, as we found out.
Amazing.
Many of the officials who were under fire remain employed by the Karolinska Institute. And despite calls for their resignations, Harriet Wahlberg and Anders Hamsten are still members of the Nobel Assembly.
Well, the saddest thing is that the families of these patients have lost their loved ones to horrible, often drawn-out, painful deaths. And also they haven't received any compensation or haven't seen any change, really, in how things are done. No apology from him, that's for sure.
No, not from him.
He operated on at least 20 patients, and all but one has died. Karolinska University Hospital never contacted Bayen's widow to discuss his death. Following his dismissal from the Karolinska Institute, Paolo worked at the Kazan Federal University in Russia, and he was dismissed from there in April 2017. In October 2017, Swedish prosecutors dropped the involuntary manslaughter charges against him. But then in December, the Swedish Public Prosecution Authority announced that it would review that decision after finding that there was a potential for bias in the case.
Yeah, and we don't know the results of that, or there hasn't been a conclusion to that yet.
I don't think so, because I couldn't find it, so I think that's still pending.
It's still pending.
I believe so.
Well, I'll tell you what, I would charge him.
Oh, he should be in prison for sure.
I would definitely charge him with this, because I think, as we found out, that he knew that this procedure wouldn't work, and he went ahead and did it anyway.
Well, and he was fired in Russia because he had no license to operate as a doctor in Russia.
Oops.
If anyone operates as a doctor without a license, I would think they'd go to prison. I mean, if you come down to it, he's a murderer. And worse than a lot of murderers who are already in prison or have even been executed. So just because he's well off and charming and has a degree, big fucking deal. He's just as bad as any murderer we've ever talked about on this show. Worse than a lot of them.
And that's why we're doing this case.
Right. Because it absolutely is a crime.
I think it is.
Yeah.
So some other fallout from all this. Sweden's Central Ethics Review Board called for a retraction of 6 of Paolo's journal articles after they found evidence of scientific misconduct. Now, of these 6 articles, 4 of them have been retracted, and this includes 2 articles in The Lancet. However, maybe amazingly, with all the notoriety surrounding him, Paolo has managed to have a paper published online in March of this year in the Journal of Biomedical Materials Research. This time, recreating the esophagus. Now, the editor of the journal said he had been unaware of Macchiarini's history, and the reviewers of the article knew nothing either.
How? How is that possible?
I have no idea.
That's just ridiculous.
The editor said that the peer review of this manuscript was rigorous, as it might have been. But nevertheless, according to one of Paolo's former colleagues, one of the whistleblowers, the paper contains the same problems as his studies in recreating tracheas.
Yeah, it's not like he's revamped the whole thing. He's still trying to push the same garbage.
Yeah, I mean, he's switched from one tube to another.
Right, exactly.
But he's doing the same stuff.
He is. Well, neither the Institute nor the hospital has made any effort to remedy the situation for those who tried to blow the whistle on Paolo. There's never been an apology, and two have had to leave the Institute. So when I think about this, to me, it really sends an unequivocal message to the employees there. Loyalty trumps the welfare of the patients. And if someone is to speak out, nothing good is going to happen to them. This is so dangerous. I mean, it reminds me a lot of what happens in politics. If you're in an institution where you're not allowed to say the truth, anything can happen.
So according to the Global Ethics Initiative, this case is a clear example of the ways in which institutional checks and balances, which would ordinarily ensure ethical research, can break down when recruiters become starstruck and institutions wish to be associated with an individual's achievements, or clinicians are eager to jump at the prospect of an innovative, effective new treatment. The medical community, the media, and the general public are constantly looking for new advances in medical technology. Scientists welcome such developments as an opportunity to advance their knowledge. Clinicians see the prospect of helping their patients. Patients and their families see hope. And journalists often see the thrill of an exciting new story that might seem like something out of a science fiction novel. Certainly, all of these factors played a role in making Paolo Macchiarini's elevation and his fall as dramatic and interesting as it was.
Now, is the idea underlying Macchiarini's work seeding a scaffold with the patient's own stem cells in hopes of regenerating a healthy, functional organ still worth testing in patients? That's the question facing scientists in the United Kingdom right now, where two trials of stem cell-based larynx and trachea transplants are planned but on hold in the wake of the scandal. Now, the larynx is the voice box, so it's in the same area.
It's at the top of the airway.
Now, both studies, led by former Macchiarini collaborator and University College of London laryngologist Martin Birchall, received approval from the Medicine and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency more than 2 years ago and have obtained close to 5 million euros from UK funding agencies. An independent inquiry last year concluded that there was no reason to cancel the trials, and UCL says that they can proceed. Now, wow. They haven't yet, but isn't that scary?
It is scary, because I think there's been enough researchers and physicians who have demonstrated this cannot possibly work. If you think about it, what you have to do with this piece of plastic that's coated with stem cells, first of all, is figure out a way to keep the stem cells attached to the plastic, right?
Right, and why would they?
And there's no reason for them to. And secondly, you need to establish some blood flow to get the cells to grow. And how are you going to get blood vessels growing in a hunk of plastic?
Well, that's what I mean. It's just common sense. Why would any doctor believe this was going to work?
So, I mean, I guess, I don't know if they're looking at the fake tubes or if they're looking at cadaver tubes.
Right.
I could see it more likely to be using autologous or cadaver tracheas or esophagi.
I can't say that there was a lot of success with that either, though.
No, but it's at least from a scientific viewpoint, it would be more workable.
Aside from all the suffering this caused, think of the money. Should we be dumping money into science that doesn't work? That's another thing to consider.
Yeah, who knows how people decide what studies are going to get funded and which aren't. So there's two clinical trials, as you said, Jill, that are on hold right now. One is the INSPIRE trial, which is a collaboration between University College of London and the regenerative medicine company Videragen, which was designed to study the safety and efficacy of a transplant for patients suffering from narrowing or softening of the trachea. The second study is the Regenvox trial, which would test the same procedure on patients with similar defects in the larynx. So these are basically the same study, just looking at different parts of the human anatomy.
Yes. Well, and in the documentary from Sweden, in Paolo's lab, he had some students, medical students, and other physicians working on creating plastic diaphragms, which is a large muscle. I don't know how that would ever work in other organs.
Well, I mean, same thing. You're putting up the scaffold and the stem cells are supposed to grow on it. Now, the diaphragm's a big muscle.
Yeah, right.
So,
and you need it to work if you want to breathe.
It certainly would. So I'm thinking, how can you even begin to believe that that would work when your tracheal experiments were such a dismal failure?
Right. Well,
anyway,
there were a lot of doctors working with him there, and all I can think is he was giving them incorrect information to lead them astray. It couldn't all be charm. There has to be a lot of deception there as well. Paolo's current whereabouts are actually unknown, but he is rumored to be living in Italy again.
Low profile, though.
Might be a good idea. I just hope that he ends up serving time, at least losing his medical license. Come on. So to find out more on this case, there are multiple articles available online. There's also the ID special, He Lied About Everything. And this is mostly about Benita Alexander and her relationship with Paolo. But it does go into some of the medical deception as well. The three-part documentary Fatal Experiments aired on BBC in 2016, and I was only able to find part one to watch on Vimeo. Now, Experiment, the Swedish documentary series, is in Swedish, and I wasn't able to find an English version, so I haven't watched that.
Well, we kind of watched it.
Kind of.
And we were trying to guess at what they were saying.
Right. We really needed someone to come in and help us interpret. So the music for this podcast was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you enjoy True Crime Brewery and you'd like to offer some support while gaining access to members-only episodes each month, please go to our website, tiegrabber.com, and join Team Tiegrabber. Or you can also go to Patreon and become a patron. Tiegrabber members also receive gifts from us and our endless admiration and devotion. Recent members-only episodes include the kidnapping of Shannon Matthews. Also the murder of Samantha Zaldivar. This month, we're attacking the White House farm murders, in which Jeremy Bamber was convicted of killing his sister, her little kids, and his parents. This case has actually been requested by several listeners over the last couple of years, and we have finally decided to cover it. Some other ways to support TCB are to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and/or Facebook. If you have a few minutes to spare, we would also love to get your review on iTunes or wherever you listen to TCB. And don't forget to send us your feedback to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com or by leaving us a voicemail on our website, tiegrabber.com.
This episode has been sponsored by ADT. ADT can design and install a smart home just for you that is backed by 24/7 protection. There's Doorman Service, which is an ADT automation that unlocks the door for packages, friends, neighbors, or your kids. Then there's Turndown Service, which is an automation that arms your system, locks your doors, and turns down your lights and thermostat. Now, this is all controlled from the ADT app or by the sound of your voice and is backed by 24/7 protection. Just visit ADT.com/smart to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.
Yeah, I think I'm going to do that this weekend because it sounds really neat. So want to start feedback with voicemails? We only have one, don't we?
We have one. We got one voicemail from Judith. So let's hear that.
Hi, Dick and Jill. It's really great to be able to leave a voicemail for you guys. I know how much Jill enjoys this. I just wanted to let you guys know how much I enjoy your podcast. I know a lot of people do. I used to be an avid listener of a lot of different podcasts on a fairly regular basis. I've been podcast listening for about 5 years now and have really enjoyed a variety of different topics. But when I was introduced to your podcast, and I can't remember how, I think it was just by happenstance, it actually stopped me from listening to a lot of the podcasts that I had previously enjoyed. That's not a bad thing. I binged listened to every single episode of your podcast. And now I wait with bated breath for Tuesday to come so that I can listen to your podcast. You guys do such a great job. I'm really excited about all of the things that you do in terms of your research and getting your facts straight and paying such close attention to the victims of every episode. So keep up the good work, and I'll see you at the quiet end.
Well, that was pretty nice, wasn't it? If we were on video, you'd see me blushing right now.
You snuck that one in on me.
I know.
It's wonderful to be complimented. Thank you, Judith. But normally I don't play voicemails that are just compliments because it just seems a little self-serving on my part. Not that I don't like them. I do like them.
Well, I put these in there actually because you had this idea that you were bouncing back and forth, and I wanted to give you an intro to it. So here's your chance.
Okay, so here's the idea. I really like to get voicemails and play them on the show. And the ones that I like to play mostly are ones that have case suggestions or that have comments that we can talk about cases we've already done. So in order to try and get more of those coming in, I've come up with a plan where any voicemail that we play on the show between now and the end of the year, that person will get a free True Crime Brewery t-shirt. So if you send in a voicemail and it has a case suggestion or some kind of comment and we play it on one of our episodes, then we are going to have you send us your address and your preferred shirt size, and we're going to send you a t-shirt. And this is just my way of blackmailing listeners into sending me more voicemails. I'm going to be honest and upfront about it. So all we had this week were complimentary ones, and this was a beautiful one from Judith. I don't want to say it wasn't great, but I'm going to bribe people. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a nice way of putting it.
Okay.
So let's hear some voicemails. We'll probably be overrun by them, trying to decide which ones to play.
Oh, I hope so. That'd be lovely.
We'll see.
But I'll stockpile them and play them. I might have enough to last a while. So, all right.
So, yeah, with that in mind, if it's submitted before the end of the year, but it isn't played until next year, you still are going to get a t-shirt.
Still counts, absolutely.
All right.
And I ordered a bunch of t-shirts, so I do have quite a few in stock.
Okay.
All right.
Let's go to our emails.
Okay, we have a case suggestion from Alana.
We do. There's a couple in here. I'll do the first one and you can talk about the second one.
Okay.
So Alana says, I'm recommending the Lori Bembenek case. You've probably already had suggestions for this. It's a familiar name, isn't it? It was the Bambi case.
Oh, yeah.
So recently, Vanity Fair Confidential did a fairly good episode on her, with as much info as it could fit into a 44-minute hour. But it's still missing some important details. Lori's goal was to become a cop like her dad. After she went through training, she was dismissed due to questionable marijuana charges based on hearsay. Now, she had some access to photographs of cops dancing naked at a bar with naked women, children present,
wow,
and packets of cocaine. And she was claiming the Milwaukee Police Department was corrupt. So an internal investigation started, until... So she married Fred Schultz, a 13-year police veteran, in January of 1981, then remarried him in November of 81, when it was determined that Fred hadn't waited the legally required 6 months after his divorce from his first wife, Christine. In May of 1981, Christine was murdered by a gunshot in her bed. Her 10-year-old son says it was a male intruder. And yet Lori was arrested June 28th for the murder, allegedly having access to Fred's off-duty revolver and a key to Christine's house. The investigation into the naked cops dancing and cavorting with strippers and using drugs was dropped. Lori's tried and convicted in March of 1982, based on questionable evidence. She escaped from prison in July 1990 with the help of cellmate's brother, Dominic Guglietti. The Toronto Sun editor, Peter Worthington, wrote a long editorial challenging the case. We in Canada, I guess that's where Alana's from, have a special regard for Lori, taking up the U.S. refrain, Run, Bambi, Run. She got caught in Thunder Bay, Ontario. She got refugee status by a leading immigration attorney who helped her with the case and won her a second trial. She would eventually take the no contest plea with time served. I thought Guglietti was very unchivalrous about her afterwards and put it all on her. I believe you could both do a much more detailed episode on the case. So I just got some quick info, and I think it's a worthwhile case. So she was a police officer convicted of murdering her husband's ex-wife. She escaped from the Techida Correctional Institute, was recaptured in Canada, which in an episode which inspired books, movies, and the slogan, Run Bambi Run. She got a new trial, pleaded no contest to second-degree murder, and was sentenced to time served and 10 years probation in December of 1992. Now, for years afterwards, she sought to have the sentence overturned.
Okay, so there's a connection here to Jeffrey Dahmer? Is that what it says?
The connection is it's the Milwaukee Police Department.
Okay, so it says May 1991, three women called into the Milwaukee police station. A boy was wandering naked, disoriented, and unable to speak coherently. Two cops arrived. A taller white male rushed out, explained they had a lover's quarrel, and the cops let him take the boy back to his apartment with him. This white male was 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer. The boy was a 14-year-old drugged Laotian, and their physiological stature is much smaller than Americans. So he wouldn't have even looked age 14, never mind an older man able to give consent. The women protested and were told to butt out and shut the hell up and not to interfere, adding that the incident was a domestic. The cops left. Dahmer promptly killed him. Dahmer had previously molested this boy's brother. Now, if the cops had done their job, they could have saved this boy's life and found some body parts in Dahmer's apartment and caught him earlier than he was caught. Had they even done a background check, they would have found his child molester record. Were they lazy, incompetent, corrupt? This is within the same time range as Bambi's claims that some Milwaukee police were corrupt. So at least incompetent. Dahmer would go on to kill four more. Some food for thought. Thanks for your many insightful podcasts. Always enjoyable, Alana.
See? Interesting.
It is. So, I really know nothing about the Jeffrey Dahmer case, which is weird because I do all this true crime stuff.
Well, we can look into that.
Okay.
I'm not sure I want to do
serial killers.
Well, yeah. And
We've done a few of them.
We have, and we're going to do one sometime this month.
Yeah, we're going to do Ed Kemper in December.
And we're doing the...
The Wineville murders. Oh, horrific.
So I guess the statement that we don't like to do serial killers, you should take with a grain of salt.
Right.
I definitely want to look into the Lori Bembenek case. That has a lot of interesting things.
Absolutely.
And maybe Dahmer.
Okay.
All right.
So I have a comment from Brenda on an inconvenient woman. In one of your videos from November 2017 titled An Inconvenient Woman, you discussed why it might be that the focus in domestic violence is why did the victim stay, or the focus is on the victim instead of being on why abusers do what they do. I learned in college that in fact there was a multi-million-dollar grant-funded research project early on when the U.S. was actively gaining awareness on issues of domestic violence and child abuse. The focus of the research project was to learn why abusers harm others. However, the abusers in the study refused to cooperate. In order to maintain the funding, the researchers quickly changed the focus of the study to be why do women stay, since abuse victims / survivors were more cooperative in the study.
That was just a thing of interest to me.
It is interesting.
I hadn't heard of that, trying to look at why abusers did what they did.
It makes sense.
Yeah, because they deny it anyway, so... So you say, so talk to me about what you did. And they say, what? What are you talking about? It wasn't me.
Well, this is something we've been called out for before, is instead of saying a woman should be careful when she goes out at night alone, we should be thinking about, well, why is the attacker attacking her? It's not her fault. We shouldn't question why she does what she does. So to me, this is similar.
Yeah.
Well, of course, we don't think that men should be out raping women. But can we teach them? It's hard to tell them, don't rape. It's a lot easier to tell women, hey, be careful. So I don't think that we're trying to blame the victim in any of these cases. And I hope it doesn't come across that way in most of our podcasts, because we definitely don't feel that way.
Oh, not at all.
No.
I have a comment from Mike on the episode Dark Water. This was the Asian Canadian girl.
She was from Canada. I think she did have Asian parents.
Yeah. Who was found in a water tank in a hotel.
Yes, and there was some thought about her mental illness, whether she was a victim of someone or if she had hurt herself because of her mental illness.
Yeah, and we were of the opinion that the mental illness or the drugs being used to treat her mental illness played a huge role in her death. So Mike writes that he had a girlfriend that was also bipolar, and the doctor had her on much of the same medications, especially the Seroquel. So his experience with Seroquel is that he would come home from work and his girlfriend would be walking around the house naked, talking to people that weren't there. She would talk in tongues. She'd turn everything in the house on. The washer and dryer would be running but empty. The stove top and oven on with nothing cooking. Water faucets were all on. She'd also take more meds, thinking she hadn't taken any yet. In Mike's opinion, the Seroquel is what did this girl in. I've seen firsthand what this shit can do.
Okay.
So, and just briefly, Seroquel is one of these atypical antipsychotics, one of the newer ones. And there are many, many side effects. And this is just some of the more common ones. Trouble sleeping, restless and unable to sit still, sweating, rapid heart rate, agitation, and hallucinations.
So what about taking excessive amounts? Would that just make those worse?
Sure. This is side effects taking the recommended doses.
Right.
You know?
Well, hallucinations explains a lot in this case.
Yeah, remember the scene in the one of the videos we watched of the elevator?
Oh, scary.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But she might have been hallucinating that people were there because it sure looked like she saw somebody.
It sure did. But I agree with Mike that the medications probably played a role.
Well, yeah. When someone goes on that kind of medication, it's really hard if someone's not there to help them, to supervise them.
Yeah, and she wasn't monitored, right?
No, she was off on her own. She went on a trip.
Yeah.
So Hillary has a comment on the mainline murder.
A recent one.
Yeah, the last one.
Yeah.
I've been listening off and on for a couple of years now, and I enjoy your show a lot. I just listened to the mainline murder episode. I was caught by surprise regarding the content. I expected it to be about the Reinerts. Susan Reinert and her two children were killed by her lover and her ex-principal in 1979. That was huge news back when I was a child in Pennsylvania, and is my first memory of something being called a mainline murder. Stephanie Newman was 2 years ahead of me in high school in Winecott, Pennsylvania, and when the news of her murder became public, I was of course horrified. We were not friends per se, but she was in my social circle as a bright and popular upperclassman who was friendly with some of the older siblings of my own friends. At the time of her death, I was living in Philadelphia. I don't recall it being called a mainline murder, but that may have been because my perspective of having grown up on the other side of the river, as we say, Elkins Park, Winecote, and Jenkinstown, are not so fancy as the mainline, and I certainly would never have thought of Stephanie as a mainline girl. Of course, I married a man from Bryn Mawr, and now my kids attend a mainline school, and my office is in Ardmore, the heart of the mainline. These days, I am more sensitive to mainline news, perhaps. Right now, if you say mainline murder to someone here, they will think you are referring to the Playboy model who was killed in her apartment last month near Suburban Square. Of possible interest, Stephanie's mother-in-law, Joyce, passed away this past April. Well, thanks for writing in, Hillary. Yeah. That's interesting. I did hear that there were 3 or 4 different murders that were called the mainline murder.
Right. This wasn't the first.
So not feeling super creative about a title last week, that's what I went with. But yeah. You know, what's interesting is the murder that she's talking about, the Reinerts, I think that was the last name of the stripper that Craig Rabinowitz was so infatuated with and killed his wife for. So, I don't know, maybe it's just a common name in the area.
It could be, but that's an interesting story about Susan Reinert. I think we should look into that because there's a lot going on.
Yeah, her lover and ex-principal, that.
I just threw in that quickie one-sentence thing without expanding on anything else. So I think I'll check into that some more.
What about the Playboy model? Did you look into that at all?
No, I haven't.
Oh, because that could be another interesting one.
Could be.
A lot of shit going down in the main line. Be careful, Hillary.
But thanks for the letter.
Yes, and thanks to everyone for your feedback today. I really appreciate it. I whine about voicemails, but I do like emails too.
We certainly do.
Yes. So we're going to go now, and we will talk to you next time. At the quiet end.
At the quiet end, I'll be there.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.